Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio brings you Rebooting the News.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jay.
This is Rebooting the News number 68.
Where's the guest? I don't see the guest.
It's just me, you, and our mute engineer, Adrian.
Adrian, say hello.
Hello.
There he is.
We've been doing this podcast for more than a year and a half.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
And a year, no, not quite a year in the studio, though. But we're getting there.
Getting there.
It'll be, like, pretty soon.
And pretty soon, we're going to be taking this show to Washington.
Yeah.
And the Online News Association Annual Convention.
Yeah.
Which is a gathering of people mostly in the industry, but also some students and hangers-on who are engaged in trying to reboot the news. So we are on the program for Saturday afternoon.
That's October 30th, right?
Yeah. In a fairly large room, as I understand, with the necessary technology to both have a public event and a radio program at the same time.
Pretty amazing.
And I figured we might spend a few moments at the start of this show and figure out what are we going to say.
I don't think we're going to say anything other than what we normally do. I mean, you know, I think that's the whole idea of doing these things, is that I used to do, in the early days of Scripting.com and DaveNet, I used to do these events at, you know, tech conferences, and sometimes there were huge numbers of people in the room. And I just treated it like, I thought of it like a blog post with all these people there participating in the post. And when I start blogging in the morning, I really don't know what I'm going to write about.
So you think we should do it with no planning whatsoever?
Well, I think that the technical side of the thing has been very well planned.
Well, that, we, yes.
We know that the AV people are absolutely top-notch, and in fact, they even listen to the show. I think they're listening right now. And
Greg Lynch.
Yeah, Greg Lynch. Yep. And
loyal listener.
It's awesome. And so that part, no, I mean, since when... Jay, how do we plan this show exactly? How much planning goes into each one of these shows? Lots, right? We spend the whole week thinking it through, right?
Yeah.
Not.
I do. But we only actually plan it right at the last minute.
It's just really what we've been doing. You know, what have we been thinking about? And I think that that should be the same. I mean, that's my opinion. Do you have a different... Should we try to explain what we mean by rebooting the news?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a strong feeling about it. However, whenever I do public appearances in front of people, live appearances, I do put some careful thought into what I want to say and how I want to present
it. But let this be the different one. You know, here's the deal. I don't think, no matter what we say, we're going to end up saying the same thing anyway.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think that you could put a lot of planning into whatever speech you're going to give. You still end up saying the same thing. You have a point of view, a way of looking at the world that's uniquely yours.
No, I understand that. Your point of view comes out no matter what you prepare.
Right, right.
Sure, I understand
that. And so you're going to tell a certain set of stories that illustrate that point of view. And I'm going to tell a certain set of stories that illustrate my point of view. And, and then we're going to have some people in the audience that have different points of view. Audience, bad word. People in the room that have a different point of view. And we'll see what happens. I don't know. I mean...
Okay.
Look, you can do whatever you want. If you want to plan it, that's cool. I'll plan it with you if you want.
I mean, okay.
I mean, but...
Well, what I was thinking of, and you tell me, I can already tell you're not going to like this idea, but why don't we...
You know that I'm going to like it now, right?
Think back on our 68 programs and identify 5, 6, 7, 8 of the key themes that we have explored again and again and
that
again.
That would be really good.
Yeah, and give that crowd the benefit of... some of the things we keep coming back to. An example would be we're already using the rebooted system of news. That has been a persistent theme, right?
I would say that is the persistent theme.
Okay, yeah. But that's a start, right?
But we come up with new things. And I think one of the things we're going to talk about today is one of the new things that we haven't talked about yet.
What's that?
Well, it was more like on a dare. You know, we did this class. You had this class. Let's go into that.
Okay.
Let's, like, let's make this. Let's come back to things we should talk about.
Okay.
Maybe we'll come back to it through the show. But you had this class. It was very interesting. You made us read eight speeches.
Eight speeches by news executives.
Right.
All trying to grapple with the reboot.
One more depressing than the other. And I had a, let's see. And I came to, as I was reading these things, and I normally would not have read them. I normally would have read a few sentences in each one as they came up, gotten horribly depressed, and hit the back button and gone somewhere else. But
you were in my class, so you had to do what the teacher said.
I took the assignment seriously. I had a solid B-plus average in college, and that's why.
Yeah, I would give you about a B-plus for your present.
Clearly, I'm worth about a B-plus.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Right. I'm not getting, well, whatever. And
so you read them all.
I read them all, and
you blogged
and what
them.
I found was there was a bug in all of their
a bug
in the way all of these people approached the question of how are their organizations going to survive the future.
Mm-hmm. What
and
was
this
the
is
bug?
How I put it. I'm going to do the direct quote, because the fundamental thing each of the speakers has in common, the one possible mistake they're all making, the one variable they refuse to consider, is the possibility that other people might do what they do for no pay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the thing we don't mention because we want to be sensitive to their feelings. I don't mention it. When I'm with these people, it's the elephant in the room, the 800-pound gorilla. It's the idea that is sitting in the middle of the whole place that they're spending all their time arguing against. I mean, if you read their arguments and you were to pull out everything that was a rebuttal, a refutal, is that a word?
A refutation
of that point, they would be left with nothing. That's
nothing.
All they were saying was refuting the point, trying to prove that you couldn't do what they do without paying people.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, how about for a while we consider, now you want to get burned at the stake at that meeting in Washington, D.C., we spend the whole hour or whatever we have talking about that, they will kill us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
But that's the reason why we probably should spend the whole hour just talking about that. You know, I once I took a lot of massage school, right? And I had a teacher who always used to ask a massage client, where does it hurt? And wherever it was, she says, good, that's what we'll do. Because that's the thing you don't want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing you have to look at the most. The thing you most don't want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
That's where your healing is going to come from, is by confronting that and finding out that there is life after that. There is news after that.
Well, suppose the people who have made journalism their life's work did confront the fact that what they do could be done for free, or much of what they do could be done for free. Why would that help them?
Because, well, first of all, why would it help them?
Yeah, because your massage therapist helps you when she says,
oh, absolutely,
where does it
because
hurt,
she
right?
works that muscle, that sore spot,
until the pain is gone.
Well, it would allow them to try to construct a future where we're actually getting news. See, because a lot of the know-how, this is an assumption, or at least some of the know-how, is locked up in these people. You know, a generation's worth of know-how is represented there, right? Presumably, these are the people who know how to do news in our society, right?
Right.
And if they're unwilling to, this was the second half of Bill Keller's. Somebody pointed this out in the comments on my blog. You know, I cited one of Bill Keller being the executive editor of the New York Times, one of his points. The second point that Keller made, well, his point was that they were able to send paid witnesses to go observe events and report on them, right? His second point was they have the highest standards of integrity. That, you know, he explains that in a lot of ways, but that was fundamentally the point that he was making. Well, if they really do have the best understanding of what those what integrity means, then they really have an obligation to teach the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're going away, that tradition needs to carry on.
Mm.
Right? In other words, if you're thinking about, if you were a doctor Yeah. And all of this, and you realized that the medical profession was going to cease to exist.
Right.
Right.
But humanity needs this knowledge, yeah, so we have to distribute it.
The responsible thing
I
to do would
saying.
Be to try to set up a system right. where at least people are getting some health care, mm-hmm. even though the doctors are not being paid to do mm-hmm. it. Right? These people are not being responsible that way. I mean, I think you can...
Well, let me press a little bit harder on this, Dave, because I'm not sure I agree with your...
Well, I would come back to you and ask you this question. What good is done by trying to pretend that the possibility doesn't exist that this stuff could be done by people who will do it?
Well, I think some of the news system could be taken up by people working for free. Of course, when we say they're working for free, that's just sort of one, a very narrow way of describing it. They're doing it for other reasons is what it really is. So some of the news system could, in fact, be taken over by people who don't require a salary and health insurance and the costs associated with a professional
because they're getting it somewhere else.
Yeah, but then there's a lot of other parts of the news system that we need that I think wouldn't actually be done at
right.
all.
Wikipedia does have some employees; they do burn through some cash.
Right.
They do spend some money. I mean, this was the thing I kept coming back to. Is if you believe that it can't be done without paid employees, then you have to explain to me how Wikipedia exists. How does Wikipedia exist?
I think Wikipedia is a very important thing to understand, and explaining how it exists, why it exists, is key to understanding the digital world that we are in. I agree with that. But this week, ProPublica published, with five partners, an investigative piece about how doctors paid by drug companies to give talks for pharmaceuticals are often among the sleaziest doctors and have all sorts of violations in their records. And many of them are kind of the dregs of the profession. And you could actually look up your doctor and find out if they had been cited for violations or...
And what was their criteria for deciding that somebody was the dregs of their profession?
They had had official proceedings against them. They had been warned by regulators. They had been disciplined in one way or another. That's important public information that I just don't think people would produce for free.
Really? It sounds like a database query to me.
Well, it's database, but it's not just a query of a database. You have to put together two different kinds of information, and you
have
to...
Well, that's what a database query does. It, you know, in other words, if you had all the speakers in one table, and you had all the disciplines in another, then you do a joint.
Well, I don't think my claim, Dave, is that it's theoretically impossible for somebody doing it for free to do it. That's obviously possible.
Right. But
it wouldn't get done.
Well, I don't know that you can make that assumption.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
I don't think it would get done.
I take stock. Okay, I'm shifting gears just a little bit. You know, when I started using, you know, when I first became a professional computer guy, it was roughly, you know, this was after I left grad school and I was headed west to California. I remember actually driving into the Bay Area and having this thought, you know, I wonder who I know who live in the Bay Area. As I'm driving across the Golden Gate Bridge for the first time as I'm moving to California, and I'm thinking, this is a benchmark, because right now there are no tools that enable me to find that out. We're very far away from that. Yet, I have no trouble conceiving of that query, right?
Yes.
You know, my hypothesis was, there are a lot of people I know living here because I went to Bronx Science, because I went to, you know, and a lot of people from Bronx Science went into the computer business, and this is where the computer business is headquartered in the Bay Area. And because I have a computer science degree from the University of Wisconsin, right, a lot of the people are here, too, because they also migrated to the computer industry. But there was no way, inconceivable in 1979, to do that query. Fast forward to 2010, it's a very simple matter. You know, All I do is...
Anyone can do it. It doesn't take a computer scientist
correct.
To do it.
You don't need... You just need to be able to do a search on Google. And Or I have my friends, you know, on Facebook you could do it. Or LinkedIn. Or some... All these networks are booting up now. And I was thinking, you know, I'm at the point in my career right now where basically all the things that I was visualizing and imagining when I was young have now happened.
Yeah.
Okay? So now I need a whole fresh set of challenges because they've all taken place.
Well,
so that question you're talking about, it's just a matter of time, Jay, before you can do that, really, honestly. That's the way you have to think about these things. That
so
we're on that path.
Where we agree is that if professional journalists saw more of their work as enabling citizens to do journalism for free, they would be on a path to discovering their next role.
Well, you know, only in that profession do we think about it that way. You know, it's only for them that we do this, okay?
What do you mean?
We
only
don't
for
spend
them?
A lot, because I don't recall a lot of people wringing their hands. Neither you or I are professional journalists, right?
Right.
Neither of us are, right? Yet here we are thinking about it from the point of view of these people finding meaning and purpose in their lives.
No,
right?
Not meaning and purpose.
Or
in their
value
lives.
In dollars and cents.
No, being able to do it full time.
Right, but that's literally more or less what you just said, okay? I'm not blaming you for this, Jay. I'm pointing something out, okay? Yet when this wave that we're talking about swept through my profession,
people didn't say, well, how are we going to employ all these computer scientists?
Correct. Open source was that, you know,
in
the early part of this last decade, in the beginning, you know, for there was 20-year period, basically, when you went from software had a lot of commercial value to software has no commercial value,
mm-hmm.
right? How many stories in the New York Times did you read about where are all the computer science guys going to get their paychecks? I don't think we ever saw that story appear once. This is the byproduct of the fact that you're talking about the profession that owns the microphone.
All right.
You know, it's a distortion. You know, why we look at it from their point of view so much is another interesting question to ask.
Okay.
Maybe we've... Okay.
Well, I don't think we should start off our show in an online news association with who cares whether you guys have jobs or not. I don't think that would put the audience on our side.
Why is it our job, by the way? Just FYI. Just
oh,
a
man,
question.
You stepped right
I'm
into that
I'm an Asian provocateur,
right.
Jay. I am that. If you look at my business card, it says it. Dave Weiner stirs the shit. It's like, that's why I never get invited to speak at these things, because people don't want their assumptions challenged. But,
come on. I think that's a bad way of going about it.
Oh, I'm smiling
assume,
when I said it.
Don't assume that. All right, we'll just do what we normally do.
All right, or we still have enough time.
I really do think, it would be very valuable for us to figure out, okay, what are the recurrent
things?
Why
don't we ask, you know, I'm always amazed by the people who listen to the show. It's like there are all these surprises. People I don't know are listening, who I'm amazed are listening. How about it? If you guys have some ideas on this one, come to rebootnews.com and say, okay, here's, you know, Jay and Dave are getting a chance.
What
to
does ONA to need to hear from Rebooting the News with Dave?
Or what do we need to say to
or
them?
Or what do we need to tell them?
In order for us to feel fulfilled, All
right, let's move on to our new topic. I want to ask you about this post, which I read, which I really loved, called The Enemy of Progress is Complexity. I thought it was one of your better ones.
People really liked that one,
What motivated you to say that, and what did it mean, the enemy of progress is complexity?
Well, what motivated me is pretty simple. There's this guy, and I'm not going to say his name. He's a former executive at Google who asked me to write this series. And he had just left Google in total frustration because this company wasn't doing this kind of work very well. And he said, you've had some success doing this, open development work. Well, why don't you write down the rules, what you've learned?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, nobody would read that. He says, yeah, you'd be surprised. A lot of people would read it. So I said, all right, that's a pretty good point. I don't care. If nobody reads it, it doesn't matter to me.
Is that the criteria?
Well, right. Let me just see if I can get it down, right? So that's where this came from.
So it's a request post in a way.
Right, a series of posts. This was the third and the sixth rule that I had come up with. And where it came from is pretty simple. It's there. there's when you're publishing a when you want to get people to implement a format or protocol to try to create some momentum, some uptake, some a developer community, or you want to create a standard, or mm-hmm. you want some basis for competition, you want to make some progress, basically, mm-hmm. is what we're talking about. Every time somebody's doing this, that's the goal. We're trying to get to a place where enough people have implemented this now that you can take it for granted.
Right.
That every development environment supports this, and now you can just build on top of it. And that's how technology works. I mean, it's layer on layer on layer on layer on layer. Mm-hmm. It's just really deep layer cake, basically. Mm-hmm. And where one layer builds on top of another.
Is that called the stack?
That's called the stack.
That's or a new term
there
to me
many
this year.
Stacks. Many stacks. And a stack really is basically that. It's creating what a word Ted Nelson taught me, which is virtuality. It's creating a virtuality out of individual components of technology that by themselves don't really mean very much. But when you add it all together, mm-hmm. it becomes a world that has its own rules that mm-hmm. you can understand, where you don't have to understand how it's made. You just
right.
understand how it operates.
Okay,
right?
Go on.
So that's good. So so what happens a lot of times is that the engineers end up in having these arguments with each other. And they say, well, you know, I have to do it this way. And another guy says, no, I have to do it this way. So they decide to do it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Aha. Uh-huh.
And when
and
they
right
do
there,
that,
they've added some extra complexity
right,
that well, we don't need.
Correct.
Because of their own Mishigas.
Mishigas, good word.
Yeah.
Right.
Yiddish.
They could have done it one of those two ways. One of the guys could have compromised
right.
and given up a little
but
bit.
But they're letting their egos get
yeah.
in the way.
And in the process, they're also... This is something else I observed in the piece, is they're hastening the day of their reinvention, because the next generation coming along is going to look at their Mishigas and say, I have a choice here. I could either understand all this shit, mm-hmm. all this Mishigas, mm-hmm. right, crap piled on top
or
of crap.
Or do it a simpler way.
Or just completely reinvent them.
Right.
Forget about them.
Oh, that reminds me, you have to talk about 1,300 journalists in Chile. Go on.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. And... So, and that eventually will happen, okay? It's a given that eventually you will get reinvented.
Mm.
But what you're trying to do in limited...
Unless you did the simplest version.
No. No, I think it goes without
Even
saying
so.
You will get reinvented mm-hmm. eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So and whenever you get reinvented, you're losing a huge amount of progress.
Mm-hmm.
You are always taking a big step backwards when that happens. Because for a couple of reasons. One is that all the people who know the old way of doing things now are obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
They have a choice. They either learn the new way, and now they have two ways of doing the same
right.
thing. Which
or
is,
they go work at Burger King.
Or right, or they die, mm-hmm. or they go away. And eventually, the new way of doing things will get as complicated as the old way, because it's going to have to mm-hmm. do everything that the old way did.
Mm-hmm.
It's only an illusion that it's simpler at the outset. It isn't actually going to be simpler when it's all said and done. This happened, by the way, with XML. XML replaced SGML. SGML had gotten too complicated, so they said, we can simplify this. And so XML eventually got as complicated as GML, and so a bunch of guys came along and said, oh, well, we can simplify this, and created JSON, and that's where we're at right now. So JSON will eventually get
okay, so let me tell you why this interests me. A lot of the technical details you have to explain, of course, I don't understand, but the idea of complexity as an enemy is also really important in progress for a democracy.
Yeah.
And Jefferson, who is often cited by professional journalists for his wonderful words about the importance of freedom of the press, and he did say wonderful words about that, was a very intricate thinker, and he had a lot of different ideas for how a population of free people could remain informed. And one of his ideas was that if you want people to stay informed, to have a stake in the republic, you have to keep public affairs from growing too complex for them. And so he actually tried to work on the informed public problem from the demand side, in the sense of let's limit the number of demands on people to understand complex structures. And one of the reasons he wanted the United States to remain an agrarian society rather than a manufacturing or urban society was that he did romanticize the farmer. That's part of it. But another part of it was that as soon as people become entangled in these huge structures of like international credit and webs of interdependence.
But we live that now.
Oh, yeah. We lost that battle.
Oh, and we're losing our...
And because we lost that battle, we have unaccountable elites.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
We have, you know, we have a banking system that can essentially screw us and remain in charge and remain rich. But anyway...
Only for a few years.
But limiting complexity is a way of informing people that has nothing to do with the delivery of information. That's my point.
Well, you realize that computer technology is all about delivering information. I mean, it's the same thing as what Jefferson's talking about. It's the same thing as reporting. What are computers used for if not delivering information? That's exactly what they're used for.
Processing
information.
Right?
And that's why we fight the same battles.
Yeah.
Right? And it's why you'll find librarians are on our
side. Librarians.
Same damn they're story the, there. Yeah. And they're on our side, too.
And educators, academics, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm perfectly aware that these that this idea works outside of technology, but... Mm-hmm. My audience, as it were, here are the people who are doing this for technology,
right.
And we're doing it to technology, and the bankers have their equivalents in the tech world, who are highly motivated to make things more complicated,
totally,
so that people don't understand what they're doing, so they can hide what they're doing,
right?
Or you know, in the case of Google, who knows why they want more complexity, but. There are certainly some people inside Google who feel that it ought to go the other way.
Yeah.
And they hide their reasons. You know, they say things like, well, we can't do that because it won't scale.
Right.
Do they ever explain why they know it won't scale? Well, no. Their attitude is very much like Bill Keller's attitude about us, which is, well, you don't need to know that. And besides, you couldn't understand it anyway.
And during the Bush years, we actually had people in power in the government who were... trying to increase the opacity of the government. That was like an agenda item they had. Cheney was an almost like opacity czar.
You know, it doesn't last very long. That the life expectancy of those kinds of strategies or tactical systems.
Well, they do collapse. Yeah.
Yeah. We're seeing that. We bought a little bit of time with the banking industry. By simply just creating another bubble.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing full well that these bubbles burst. And so we know that we're going to see another burst, and it's going to bring us down lower than the last one did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what Krugman, that's why I like to, you know, to go really far afield here. That's why I like Krugman, because Krugman is out there just basically constantly repeating the same thing. He's like, come on, let's... be smart about this.
Mm-hmm.
And no, we don't want to be smart about
mm-hmm.
this. And I think that the public have spoken. And Jefferson, for all that we admire about him, would probably be very disappointed in us now. And
yes.
Yeah. I mean,
I think so.
We're about, well, let's not.
We're living some of his nightmares.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Fios is beautiful. I love Fios.
Yeah, yeah. You moved into a new situation.
Yeah, I have a new apartment. I moved to a place that has Fios, and it was one of my goals. And you, I know, have Fios.
We
as
do,
well, right?
Yeah.
And I haven't really explored it yet because it's so new, but it's the biggest pipe I've ever had in my house, and it's symmetric. And symmetric's important.
Isn't that cool?
It's very important. And
the same speed up.
As
loading
down.
As downloading.
And what that means is you've got a very large geography on the east coast of the United States where you have this symmetric thing going on. And what that means is, and I wrote another piece about this one, although I don't think too many people have tuned into this one. Maybe I need to write it again. But I think you're going to see an Apple II-like phenomenon here where people who are just hobbyists have the ability, all they have to do is find a spare Mac or a PC, and all of a sudden they can start a web service. They can start something, put something on the net, and allow other people to use it. And that is very much like the spirit that started the PC revolution. I mean,
in other words, the same speed up and down allows for people to have their own servers.
Correct.
And to be themselves.
The cable companies.
The providers.
That's right. Yeah. The cable companies, because they're in the TV business as well, primarily in the TV business, don't view us that way.
Yeah.
They see us as people who consume things. We watch things.
Yeah.
We don't
Here's an example. This would be a perfect thing as an ongoing theme of Rebooting the News to share with ONA. Same speed up as down has been a theme of our show.
There you go.
And it connects to something else that I wanted to talk about in this show, which is this wacky memo that the Washington Post put out to its own people after someone running the Washington Post Twitter account had the gall to actually answer back someone on Twitter who had criticized the Washington Post. And the people in charge, the managing editors, sent out a note telling their employees that Twitter is for users to engage with us, but we shouldn't engage with the users. And basically slapping down the people who had dared to talk back to the users on Twitter, which is another way of saying that we should be one way. We should have a different speed for downloading user comments than we have of uploading our own replies, right?
Right.
And we should kind of like remain one way because that's where our credibility lies, as opposed to saying, you know, when people criticize us on Twitter, we should really figure out how to respond, as opposed to never respond or don't do that. We should figure out like how we want to engage, because engagement goes both ways. This idea of one-way engagement is so amazingly deeply buried in their, you know, their mind.
Oh, it's unbelievable. They don't even see it.
That it comes out, yeah, almost like in a neurotic or Freudian way.
Well, it's like a newspaper has a public editor, but the public editor is one of them. That's wrong.
And
the we
still
have a distance between you and me. I just think absolutely wrong. The public editor ought to be the one person in their organization, if they have just one, who's a foreigner.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So that they can actually find out what a public thinks.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing, Jay, is that it's not
Wouldn't it be great if it was the dentist or something?
Right.
You know, somebody who really read the New York Times, but he was a dentist in Forest Hills,
yeah.
And he was the public editor. That would be
right.
Cool. Yeah.
Then I think you would find that they wouldn't, you know, the thing still burns me up, the whole Maureen Dowd situation. They never answered the damn question.
Right.
You know, did she plagiarize? Yeah, she plagiarized. But they never said it.
Martin Nisenholtz. The head
of that was a good one.
The digital side of the New York Times.
Wait, before we move on, I just want to say, because this is going to relate to what that Martin story, because I want to talk about this for sure.
Yeah.
Is that it might be that first you have to accept criticism coming back over that pipe, and then once that has been established, that channel exists, the next thing that's going to start coming is news. News is going to start flowing the other direction, which is, of course, how it has to work.
Yeah.
It has to work that way.
Yeah.
These guys have to
first they beat you up, and then they start giving you
news. Then they realize, wait, this is a channel to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Now, let's see if we can use it this way, too.
Yeah.
And the point is that unless they broaden that pipe, they're never going to be relevant in the world that they exist in now. They have to carry a lot more information to be relevant. And so holding on to the shape of the pipe and the dimension of the pipe and the direction of the pipe, all these are things that are holding them in place and keeping them from changing. So
equal speeds down and up.
Right.
Also, another way would be
to,
if you just think of even criticism that sounds like an attack is information. If you just treat it all as information, that's a good first step.
Well, when you're holding on to something, a massage therapist will say this, you know, when you're holding on to something, that back of yours is really tense for a reason. Because if you were to relax, you would have to accept that new reality. And you don't want to accept it at all costs.
It's the clench.
That was the thing I kept hearing. Yeah. Anyway, so let's go to Niesenholz.
The old
and
media clutch.
And the, Martin and the iPad app, right?
Well, last night I was at this event at Columbia.
Really?
When he said this, which was the inaugural lecture by Emily Bell, former head of the Digital Guardian operation, who is now moving to Columbia Journalism School to head up this new center they have that is studying digital media. And Martin Niesenholz was there to welcome her and introduce her. And in the course of doing that, he led on that 13 different teams had to work together in order to construct the New York Times iPad app, which was released recently. And that was, in itself, was just kind of fascinating.
You know, you can tell, by the way, as a user.
13 different teams.
And they missed the mark.
Had to collaborate.
Completely missed the mark.
Is that because it's such a complicated thing? Or is that because it's a bureaucracy?
It's overwhelming. And it misses the mark by a mile. I mean, the lame app that they had there before, which was Times Editor's
Times Choice or something,
was better.
Yeah, really.
Even though it had 1/100th the amount of content, it was at least approachable.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is overwhelming, and it just outstrips the ability of the iPad to do anything with it. It just is unusable. And not only that, they didn't look at prior art, and the prior art would have said, this thing has to download the newspaper so that I can read it on an airplane that doesn't have net access. Or so I can read it on the subway while I'm commuting. And it doesn't do that.
Mm.
It requires a net connection to work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you pop up, when you actually access this thing, you see the menu of different sections, and you go to each section, and you realize how much content there is. You can't get through it. The problem is, Jay, they said they could, and they couldn't give on this one, is that apparently couldn't give on it. They said, this is a newspaper on a tablet computer.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to behave and look and feel just like the print paper.
Mm-hmm.
No way.
Mm.
That doesn't work. It doesn't scale. And a much better approach would be reverse chronologic. Let me go there. And this is the way people will actually use it, okay? Is I go to this thing. Why do I go to the New York Times on my iPad? I want to find out what's new. That's all I care about. What just happened? That's what they ought to focus on. It's kind of set. You're laughing because it makes sense?
Yeah, also another theme of our show.
News ought to be about what's new, huh?
Mm-hmm.
This strange, radical idea.
No, the river of news.
I know.
Is,
yeah. I'm so tempted to say, why don't we start a project here at NYU, get some students together, and let's make an iPad app out of the New York Times that actually works without consulting a single department at the New York Times.
Well,
not one department gets to say in how this thing works.
Right. Number of departments? Zero.
Because, I mean, poor Martin Niesenholz, if he had anything to do with this project, trying to keep all those people happy. Well, this goes back to the enemy of progress is complexity.
Is complexity,
there
yeah.
You go.
Yeah, there's our theme.
Yep.
All right, now let's talk about 1,300, or some said it was 2,000 journalists there in the Chilean desert to report on the rescue of the 33 miners.
How much of that did you watch, by the way?
I watched some of it. I watched maybe half an hour.
Half an hour.
Yeah.
I watched some of
the retrospectives also on CNN, which rolled endlessly.
I imagine, but it did. I skipped that.
But it just struck me that they're not getting it. They're not understanding the new economy of news if the world's news organizations are sending 2,000 journalists all to cover a single event that was on television live. That there was a feed both inside the mine and outside the mine, right, that allowed everyone to see what was going on. So in addition to that, at great expense, you have to send thousands of journalists to Chile to essentially tell us what we can see with our own eyes. And it's only a deluded and intransigent and almost like infantile, I won't change, you know, sort of stamping its feet, industry, with fingers in its ears saying, I don't hear you about the new economy. I can't hear a thing you're saying about this new...
They don't even hear themselves,
it's,
Jay.
It's unbelievable. So as I wrote on Twitter, wait a minute. You're saying you're sending 1,300 people to cover this event, and you're asking us who's going to pay for the Baghdad Bureau at the same time? Are you sure this is what you want to say? You're sure now? And then what some of the people who follow me on Twitter who happen to be professional journalists were saying back to me is, what do you mean it's a big story? Well, I actually agree. It was a great story. It was a very compelling human drama. It was amazing. This rescue was amazing. The interplay of countries, the human struggle, the human interest of it was fascinating. But the idea that you can just send your people so that you have your own representative there is just egocentric, wasteful, boastful, narcissistic. It's just absurd.
Wait a minute. They're not going to even get that story anyway. They're sending those people there, but they're not coming back with that story.
They're not coming back with any special story at all. No. There's no story to get. It's all there on the surface.
I have another question, okay? I just got CNN again for the first time in a while. I watched it
Channel 100
last night. And it was the first thing I saw was an analysis by Roberts. What's his name?
John Roberts.
John Roberts. That is one of those maps up there. And Wolf Blitzer is listening and, you know, sort of asking him. And John Roberts is playing out the scenario to see how the Republicans can get to 50 seats in the Senate. And this seems to be
the
big issue, right, with the map. This seems to be, I mean, I'm just guessing because I have not been watching this, that this has been a recurring theme in their coverage, you know.
Sure, and will the Republicans take that? That's the thing that's...
But I seem to remember that they were telling us not too long ago that 60 was the number that you needed to have, and that 50 would be a meaningless number.
So I think they're talking about the House.
No. The filibuster thing.
That 60 is what's...
But they're talking about 50. In other words, in all of this analysis that they're doing, I mean, they're not even listening to themselves. I kept wanting to yell back at the TV. I said, but you were just telling us a year ago that they couldn't do anything because they didn't have 60. And now you're telling me that it somehow...
Well, there is one thing you can do when you have 50, and that is you can name the majority leader, and that person is extremely powerful. Huh? That is the third most powerful person in the government.
I see.
It only takes 50 to be in control of the Senate, and then all the committees also turn over to the Republicans, and that's the real sluice way for the money, because the Republican chairman get the campaign contributions from the industries.
So I guess the Republicans will know how to use that where the Democrats didn't.
Try to use it, but, you know.
Okay. So maybe there is something to it.
By the way, a little cosmic return here. You're a graduate of Bronx High School of Science. My daughter was just there looking at it, and I was there myself.
Yeah. Really?
Because she has to apply to high schools this year. So she's going to apply to Stuyvesant. She may also put Bronx Science High School down.
I thought you had to choose one. That was my...
You do. You have to rank them.
I thought you had to actually only could apply to one. When I was applying high school,
you put them in order.
Really?
Yeah. And so she's visited both of them.
Back when I was... Bronx Science was the better of the two when I was applying high school. I don't think it's true anymore, though. I think... Why are you laughing?
Because the people who went to Stuyvesant around the same time say Stuyvesant
was
the better
one. No,
they're
wrong. It was not the better one. No, I'm telling you, because... Okay. I'm telling you, I'm actually a good source on this one, because I aimed high when I applied, and I had... You know, and I think the rules were different. You could not apply to both Stuyvesant and... There were three schools, Brooklyn Tech, Stuyvesant,
and
Bronx
Science.
And
there's more now, yeah.
60 seconds.
You could only apply to one of them. You couldn't apply to all of them. So if you pick the best of them and got rejected, there was always the question, maybe if I had gone for number two,
right,
I would have gotten in.
Yeah. It's sort of the same.
So it's a little bit of a game that you had to play.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'm absolutely sure that Bronx Science was the hardest one to get into. Let's
All right.
That way.
Well, it worked out.
Well, in a matter of speaking, but I'm sure your daughter will do very well, and I'm absolutely sure she'll get into the
test is this weekend, so it's a big weekend for her.
Well, just tell her, my advice is just relax. It's an IQ test. It's not an achievement test. And so if she's smart, which of course she is, she'll do very well, I'm sure.
Ten
Another
seconds.
Great week of rebooting the news.
All right, Jay.
See you next week.
Right.